your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
My wife, Dr. Barbara Nemko, she's a frequent co-conspirator on this program, has just read the 22 articles on career issues in my new book, The Best of Marty Nemko, 3rd edition, and she has noticed a lot of things that seem, well, let's just say contrary to everything she's heard, including some things she downright disagrees with. So I thought it might be interesting, helpful, maybe fun for you, dear listeners, to hear her probe me on those. So without further ado, the CEO, if you will, of the Napa County Schools, more formally the superintendent of the Napa County Office of Education and winner of 7 national awards for her leadership, Barbara Nemko, fire away.
Yes, hello to you too.
Well,
so yeah, I read this book. Of course, I've read it in its various stages while you were writing it and after it was published. And I do work in a place where we hire lots of people. So there are many things in here I agree with, some of which I think I even contributed. And then there are a couple of things that I'm thinking, are you kidding me?
A couple. You told me a bunch. I'm just waiting.
Of you.
I've got a shield here, just waiting, you know, to try to fend off your bullets, or maybe even in a show of statesmanship to agree that you're correct.
Oh well, yes. Okay.
Well, go ahead.
So let me start with this one because this sort of defies even my imagination.
Uh-oh.
Everybody talks about how much fun it is to work for a startup. I've been to some in San Francisco. They're very casual. People seem like they're kind of floating around. You get to do all kinds of things in a startup. They're very creative, and people look like they're playing a good deal of the time. They've got ping pong tables and other things. Food is everywhere, and it's free. And I've heard, although I didn't actually see that, that sometimes they have people there who give the workers massages. So how come you think working for a startup isn't good? Which part of it don't you like?
Because a startup is not a startup any more than a restaurant is a restaurant. And it may be that, you know, I don't know the startups that you were attending. Maybe they were highly successful ones. But, you know, having had 5,400 clients at this point, many of whom worked for startups or work for startups, those are outliers. Those are aberrations. Yeah, they may have the ping pong table there. But what they don't tell you is how often a startup struggles to make payroll and ends up not paying, let alone the stock options that put dollar signs in the workers' eyes and end up being worth nothing because the company doesn't even stay in business, let alone go public. Also, startups are normally a person or two who's got a very good idea, but they don't know anything about how to organize a business. So the processes are disorganized. And so many, many people, while they're attracted to the massage, to the ping pong table, to the free food, to the foosball, many of them end up being very unhappy in a startup, unless they like to play. But even there, startups, there's so much pressure because, you know, the meter is always running. They call it burn rate. And so unless the new idea, the startup's got this cool new software, typically it's software, this app for meditation or using psychedelics to deal with depression and monitoring it, unless they bring in money fast, they don't make payroll and they're out of business. So there's a frenetic quality that can be fun and an adrenaline rush, but it ends up often being slipshod. How often a startup will release a piece of software that is buggier than my plants on my front yard because they got to get some money in. So, you know, while there are exceptions and the ones we all, you know, that make it to go public and make $1 zillion for their founders and they're retiring and donating $10 zillion to charity by the time they're 30, those make the news. But unfortunately, at least in my pretty good sample size of experience, they are the exception more than the rule.
Okay, so the trick is it's really fun to work for the successful startup. If only we could predict when we go in which one will or won't be successful.
Well, you can. You can. And that's an important takeaway. During the interview process, not only should you sit there being bombarded with their questions, but in preparation, looking at the leadership team, what's their track record? Are these newbies straight out of college, or have they successfully made startups work in the past? If the leadership has got a track record, that says a lot. ask them about the processes. If you're going to be, for example, in quality assurance, and very often you may wear multiple hats, ask them, are you the first person to be hired for quality assurance? Why did the previous person leave? What is their process? How do they get good feedback from, how do they get feedback from customers? So being like on a good first date, you're not going to bed with that startup on the first date. You want to check them out just like they're checking you out. And that way you can reduce the risk of that startup being a bad one and maximize the chances of, if not getting ultra rich, but at least making your stock options worth something and at least enjoying the excitement that indeed can exist in a startup.
Okay. Otherwise, ping pong tables and free food, you could stay home and play, but you're not going to make any money.
Just, you know, I just went yesterday to a KELW kind of a party celebration at a really cool place on 20th and Telegraph that has a ping pong table. They have beer and yummy veggie foods and stuff, and a ping pong table. It was a blast from the past. Anyway, we should be serious. Okay, ask me.
I am being serious. People are really attracted to that. Go get a job that pays you, and then go out and play at the ping pong table.
That's true, but I mean, talking about the, the KELW party, I mean, was not exactly what people are listening to work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko for, so that's what I mean by, let me get back to being serious. Okay, hit me again with your next hard, question.
Your book says that you think working in teams has big downsides, but everybody says it's all about collaborating, it's all about teams, that's what we need to teach kids. So are you just being your frequently contrarian self?
No, I never ever take a contrarian position for its own sake. But when something is so universally touted as the magic pill, the answer, and if my experience with my clients is that it isn't quite as laudatory as is suggested, I do look for those opportunities, because to merely jump on a bandwagon that everybody already agrees with doesn't do any good. So, of course, there are some good reasons for a team. For example, a too hierarchical workplace where there's a top-down boss and disempowers everybody is not good. Another good reason for a team is very often projects are complicated enough that no one person could do it themselves. So it's not like teams are bad intrinsically. But I have seen so often where teams are a nightmare for the following reasons. Especially of late, there's been a recent trend in the last year or two to have salary, you know, compensation bonuses based on what the team's productivity is. And what that does, I've had a number of frustrated clients who were both high-end performers and low performers. The high performers are frustrated because they say the low performers in the group know that they'll get the same money, and all the extra work rides with the high performer. On the other hand,
that's exactly what a lot of kids in school say.
Exactly. And conversely, and this may be a little more surprising even, the low-performing people say, you know, it's too tempting to slack, because I know the high performer is going to get, you know, it's going to do the work and I'll get the benefit. So that's a hidden disadvantage of teams, when especially if compensation is tied to it. But perhaps more central to the common good is, whether it be a for-profit or a non-profit or a government agency, when decision-making is made by teams, I'm not talking about dividing the labor so that each person gets to do a different component of the work, but when decision-making tends to be collaborative and team-oriented, it makes decision-making so slow. And here in the San Francisco Bay Area, where speed matters a lot, especially in technology, your work group is going to be behind the eight ball and too slow. And even worse is that, in order to gain a measure of consensus, usually the only way a team can gain consensus is by finding something everybody can agree to, and that normally is a tepid compromise solution, which vitiates the possibilities of bold solutions. And that's why I have deep concerns about the ubiquitous praising of and adoption of teams. Teams are like curry. They are an excellent spice in small quantities when they're appropriate, but you're not going to put curry on ice cream.
Absolutely not. I would agree with that.
So does,
you know, I guess it sort of depends on what you consider teams. I can't say that I think that working all day, every day, as a team makes any sense to me whatsoever, because I think you'd spend an awful lot of time
But nobody does that.
But I'm thinking that one of our biggest projects in our office, which was our digital early literacy project, could not have succeeded without our team, without a team made up of people with very different strengths who were all part of the team for different reasons. There was the technology people, because that was a component of making it work. There were the early childhood people, because they knew what we could and should and couldn't do with kids who were 3 and 4 years old. There was the idea of going digital, and so that was the sort of the spark that started it. There was the evaluation person. So we have a big team, and then there was the person who just managed stuff like we need to have these people go out here on this day and do this presentation for those people. So teams can be invaluable, because just having the idea, if you come in with the idea and you don't have all the people with different strengths that it takes to make it work, that it could die.
Barbara, I stipulated to the fact that when there is a complicated project requiring different skill sets, a team may indeed be necessary.
Okay.
But I was talking about, it was two caveats. One was that collaborative decision-making tends to be slow and a problem. And also when there is group compensation, where the group, their pay or their bonus is contingent on the group's performance, both the high and low performers tend to be unhappy. Okay, but what's not awful is KALW. And what we have to do, and I really, this is the only hour, I promise you, dear listeners, and I will keep it short because my dear KELW listeners like these short pledge breaks, but we need you to support us. So all you need to do to support KELW, good public local radio, and if you especially, if you like work with Marty Emco, because this is the only time, 1-800-525-9917, basic membership $60, and for $120, you get a copy of The Best of Marty Nemko, 1-800-525-9917. Now, Barbara, I do not want you to hype the book, but since that's what I'm giving away, I'm an autographed copy of Best of Marty Nemko, the brand new 2018 third edition. What is your honest appraisal, having now read the first 22 essays of the 86 in the articles in the 80s of the 86 in the book, what is your honest, really honest appraisal of the book?
If I were in need of a different job, I would swallow it whole. It has so much really down-to-earth, day-to-day advice in everything from preparing for the job interview, even how to prepare your resume, how to be ethical and yet make sure that you let your best talent shine, to getting the job and how do you make the most of it. And I know it's good because, she said modestly, I contributed some of the things to it. I was very blessed to have you as my career coach.
Anyway.
And while I don't suggest everybody marry you, I think it's really helpful have some of the ideas that you gave me that I followed, and I got a wonderful, fabulous job.
That's quite an image, having everybody marry me. I think I don't know if I could quite handle that. 1-800-525-9917 is the number for what? To support Work with Marty Nemko and KELW. We really, you know, people don't realize this, but Barbara and I do not get paid. This is our wonderful work that we love to do here for you. But it costs a lot of money to run a station. There's insurance and technology and whatever. And this is your only chance to vote for Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. Every dollar is a vote for the show. 1-800-525-9917. At the basic level, it's $60. And for $120, you will get an autographed copy of the just-published third edition of Best of Marty Nemko. It's the best 86 of my, would you believe, 3,000 articles for your work life. They've appeared in everywhere from Time to The Atlantic to many in Psychology Today, U.S. News, etc. And yes, of course, there are some people who prefer to do this online. It's quick and it's easy and it's a credit card or whatever. All you need to do is go to KALW.org. And now, in honor of you, dear listeners, who don't like these long requests for money, we stopped here, and let's get
Wait,
back to what
one
you
thing.
Want.
You stop.
Okay.
I want to say one thing.
All right.
For people who are listening. It may not be you, but you may have kids who came home from college and they're still sitting on your couch. And these are the things that you don't learn when you go to college, because that's not what they tell you. These are the practical things, so this will be a great book for them.
We do forget about the book. We do try, certainly on this show, to be practical for you, whether you're 16 or 76, for-profit, non-profit. We really do try to be truly equal opportunity here. If you've liked the workovers or the interviews that I've done with everybody from psychiatrists to sex workers to last week Simon Winchester, for any of those reasons, if you want to support Work with Marty and Emco and Barbara Nicole, we would be honored with your support at any level. The phone number, 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917. And really, let's get back to giving people what they really want, which is to hear us argue about work-related questions. Okay.
Argue? Us?
Yes.
Never.
Right. What's your
Unheard
next? Of. I want your best.
Absurd.
Your toughest criticism of something I said in the book.
Okay. So you said that you should tailor your job to suit your strengths and interests, just like you would go out and buy a suit or a dress, and you would tailor it to exactly your dimensions. Well, that's really nice. And some of us have the luxury of being able to do that. But most people get hired to do a specific job. And if your job is to sew buttons, they don't want you coming in and designing pins to put on the dress. So I don't know how practical that is.
There is no question that if your job is simply as a data entry clerk or to simply all day answer phones from irate customers, no, you're probably not going to be able to tailor the job to fit you. But even, let's take even in that most extreme circumstance, and then we'll get to a more typical one. If, you know, there are little ways to customize your life. Let's take that horrible situation. I can't imagine doing the job. You're sitting there in one of those phone banks and waiting for people to call in because they hate Verizon, you know, or whatever, or, you know, GM cars, and they're calling to complain, right? Even there, you can be distinctive in the way in which you interact during your breaks. I remember when I was a teacher, I grow roses, and I would bring roses in all the time to the fellow teachers in the teacher's room. I am a little more playful than the average person, and I would make little jokes even to the, you know, to my fellow teachers. And if I'm sitting there in a boiler room answering questions, I'd make little jokes in between calls. I would do whatever I could, even in that most extreme circumstance, to make it my own. Underneath my desk, I might, if I like oriental rugs, I'd have this little small 2-foot by 2-foot area rug. I might have a picture of my doggie. I might be asked permission if I can bring my doggie to work. You know, I would do little things even in that extreme circumstance. But in most situations, even if, let's say, you're an accountant and in your office, in the Napa County Office of Education, there's about 20 accountants or 10 accountants, whatever, in your office, I'm sure that there are some tasks that are better suited to some accountants than others. They may like looking at spreadsheets, or they may hate it. They may be rather delivering the good news or bad news to customers about what they need to data and need to provide. They may be good at data visualization and presenting to the school board about what the budget is looking like. I'm merely asking you to not be a passive little indentured servant and just passively taking whatever is assigned to you. Do think of your job, where possible, as a suit of clothes that you can tailor and accessorize within reason. I mean, you may not be able to poke holes in the middle and make it a Swiss cheese suit, but you can certainly put a pin or a scarf or a different belt. And so I'm inviting you in your job, to the extent reasonably possible, to either on your own or with your boss's permission, to tailor it to make it your own. Do you buy that?
Well, I think you can tailor your work life to some extent.
Right.
Some of the examples that you gave would be putting a rug under your desk. That doesn't do anything to your job. It just makes your day-to-day existence there more interesting.
I was talking about that extreme.
Roses for your colleagues. So, yes, absolutely you should allow your personality to shine through, assuming you have a decent personality. Use it with your colleagues. I'm just saying that you can't expect that there will be too much tailoring of the job. You can tailor a little bit how you do the job. If I had a job and my task was to deal with angry people all day long who were calling in, I would challenge myself to see, how many of them in a day could I get out of their bad mood and turn around? And I would I would tally it and give myself a reward right. on the day that I was able to turn more than 50% around, or maybe in those kind of jobs, more than 10% is a good day. But that's how I would tailor it in my own mind.
But Barbara, do you disagree with my? I deliberately gave an example that was applicable to your office. Various accountants aren't there a variety of tasks which could, while in theory your basic job they're assigned to do, you know, this amount of spreadsheets and this amount of data visualization and this amount of calling and explaining things to a principal what they have to do, but isn't it possible for, with or without the boss's permission, depending on the situation, the head of accounting, to go and trade tasks for the ones that they do better with somebody who might trade? So somebody, as I said, who would rather be doing data visualization and visual presentations of the accounting data for more of their workday and less, say, of the spreadsheets, trade with somebody else who hates the visualizations. Isn't that realistic? And that's really tailoring the job.
I don't know. I guess it theoretically it would be possible. I will have to ask around and see if they ever do that.
Okay. Ask me another hard question. You've read my book, The Best of Marty Namco. You found a lot you agree with and some stuff you found, let's say, you were quizzical about.
Well,
hit me
yeah.
with something else.
Everybody knows, and you hear it said again and again and again ad nauseum, that people who have degrees make $1 million more over their lifetime than people who don't have college degrees. And you don't agree about the degrees, so how come?
I used to agree when the data first came out. That was reported in 1970, and that's when only 40% of students went to college. So that was it was a very unusual thing to have a college degree, and so over their lifetime, they're going to earn a lot more. Now we send 70% of students to college, and so a college degree is not as much of a premium as it used to be. That's one thing that makes it, but unfortunately, the college's marketing departments, which are much more powerful than people realize, continue to perpetrate that on the media, onto the public perspective. Students, and so people continue to believe that. The other thing that makes that statistic invalid, and believe me, higher education people are very good at lying with statistics, is that it implies that the causal factor for making that $1 million more is the college experience or even the piece of paper, when in fact the pool of people who go to college, even though within that 70%, are brighter, more motivated, better family connections, are physically healthier than the pool of the 30% who don't, who may be more likely to be dyslexic or have family members who are themselves deeply struggling or who are not very motivated. So you could lock in the closet that 70% of people going to college, and they would earn a ton more money than the 30%. So it is not that the college caused that. It is that the it's a very different, in part at least. I'm not saying there's no value added from college. I would never say that because it's not true. But certainly the pools of the college-bound and non-college-bound are very different. So this notion that, hey, since I'm going to make $1 million more, of course I'm going to go into debt for $150,000, that is very, very, very misleading, especially if you're the kind of student who did poorly in high school. The chances are that if you go to college, you're going to be one of the 40% who drop out, even if given 6 years, but you'll still have the mountain of debt and the assault to your self-esteem. And that's why that canard of a statistic, certainly misleading of a statistic, that people who go to college earn $1 million more is grossly, and I'm not exaggerating, grossly misleading.
Well, I have to say you made some really superlative points in there. It makes perfect sense. I am disheartened by the fact that as the statistic is repeated over and over again, that they're still using 1970s data, because that's incredibly invalid.
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. Okay, try me again. Come on, you got to give me one where I have to. I want you to give me a really hard criticism of some aspect of the book that I'm forced to say you're right.
Okay. Are you ready?
I'm as ready as I can be, I guess.
Everybody interviews people who are trying to get jobs, right? People apply, and you go through the paper screening, and you invite some candidates in, and you interview them.
Right.
And that's how everybody hires,
right.
And you say that's a terrible way to choose who to hire.
At the risk of sounding like an academic, the research is clear that interviews have very terrible poor predictive validity for the following reasons. Sometimes the very weakest candidates are the ones most prepared for the interview because they know their work history is bad. And so they're the ones more likely to hire a coach to prep them to, for example, provide a perfect explanation for that, quote, that gap in employment or, you know, the answers to the standard questions like tell me about yourself or what's your greatest strength, your greatest weakness. So very often you're seeing a show in which that person who in the end would be a bad employee, their best day is the interview because they spent a fortune or a hell of a lot of time preparing, whereas a really great candidate may know their substance is so good that they feel they don't need to. So that's one of the reasons. The other thing is there is biases, even though today, to avoid racism, sexism, etc., many, many workplaces, especially in government and the nonprofit sector, and for-profit as well now, are asking every candidate the same question in the same tone of voice. They ask the same question monotonically. They may even do it on the internet. A lot of the interviews now are being done on the internet with one video of the questions so that every candidate gets the same thing. But if as soon as you see a person, there is a natural tendency for you, people like themselves. And it's not just race, class, gender, sexual orientation. There is a pace. There is, you know, how quickly somebody talks. Even their way of breathing, their way in which what's called latency, how long they wait to talk after somebody asks the question. These have nothing to do. So in other words, if I finish talking and somebody jumps right in the first second, some interviewers might really like that. On the other hand, some people might say that's almost rude. They need to have to leave more time. These are all factors that lead to judgments about a candidate that have nothing to do with how good the employee is. So that's why interviews are a terrible, terrible technique. And I'm not delusional enough to think that employers are going to stop doing interviews. But that's why I beg, and that's why I literally beg my candidates who are in a position to hire. I say, please make the interviews primarily simulations of difficult but common tasks that are going to be done on the job and have each of the candidates do that simulation, whether it's run a meeting, whether it's do a bit of coding, whether it's to analyze a set of data, whatever it is, right there in the room so that they can't hire a hired gun. That's going to be a better indicator. And then the other thing that I do recommend is while certainly coached job applicants can have concocted answers to all the questions they're afraid of, like, you know, why have you been unemployed so long? And what's your greatest strength, greatest weakness? But if you probe the experiences that they list on their resume, not just say, tell me more about this, but let's say they're talking about some task. They saved the company $7 zillion doing X. Tell me more about that. What was your exact role? What did you do? What problems did you face? Tell me more about that. When you dig deep into something concrete, that's going to be much more revelatory of what the person's real competence, strengths, and weaknesses are than if you ask stock questions like, tell me your greatest strength and greatest weakness. Those are some of my thoughts about interviewing. What do you think, Barb?
Yeah, I buy that. I buy that. I think people should have to talk through what they would do if X happened.
But that's a hypothetical.
I'm not talking hypothetical. I'm talking about if things that typically happen in this particular workplace. What would you do if this happened?
I want them to do it. I don't want them to say what they would do. I want them to in a role play situation where possible. Or I want to look back at what they did do. If they're going to be managing people, I want to say, tell me about a difficult employee that you managed and a really challenging situation. Then they're going to tell their story, and that's still not going to tell me enough because that could be kind of prepared. I'll listen very carefully and ask a probing question. You know, like, well, what did the employee say at that point? And then how did you respond? And what was the aftermath? By digging beneath the first question, you often can gain really good insights into what that candidate really is like. Make sense?
Yes, I like that.
Okay, and something else I like is KALW. I've been here 28 and a half years. Barbara and I have been together here for 28 and a half years.
I'm not that old.
Yeah, right. And we're honored to be doing this. We think of it as a privilege. But what we have to do, it's not our favorite thing to do. I'd be lying to you if I did. We have to bring in some money so that KLW can run. So if you like Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, and more broadly, if you like KALW or any of the programs, the fine local programming or the national programming, where you just Fresh Air was on right before this, or local programming like Philosophy Talk, or there's shows about prisoners' issues, there's marijuana issues, there's a, you know, there's the music shows. I keep looking at Joanne Marr and folk music and beyond. You know, if you like Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, this is your only time to do it. The, you know, at a $60 basic, you get a bunch of KALW swag. $120, you get an autographed copy of the just-published third edition of The Best of Marty Nemco. For those, any of those reasons, we would love your support, and I consider it a, you know, kind of a pat on the back. I know Barbara does, too. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917, or go to KALW.org. Barbara, without hyping it, since we're giving that autographed copy of The Best of Marty Nemco away for $120, tell them something about it that gives people a real flavor for what it's, what the book really is like.
I think the book is pretty much a Bible for both job candidates and employers, to give you some real insight into how do you get, have the best office in town. All very specific suggestions for what to do, like the one that you just talked about. How do you hire? And yes, our hands are pretty tied these days. You have to ask everybody the same question, and we tend to go around, and you do question one, and you do question two, but we are allowed to follow up. Person says something, we're allowed to ask a question, and I think that's where the real strength lies. Okay. So I would say that during this pledge drive, this show is very different than most of the shows on KALW. This show really can help your own personal pocketbook and that of your children, or your spouse or your parents. So if employment is an important topic in your life and this show has helped you, including how to negotiate for your final compensation, then it would be wonderful to say thank you by pledging during this hour for this show.
And it's the only hour. This is the only time. 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org. And I do need to correct, while much of the book focuses on career, I have learned over the years from my 5,400 clients that often people's careers are impeded by other factors, relationships, issues of gender, money. And so I've got articles on each of those. Stress, certainly, substance abuse. There, you know, anybody who just is a career counselor and focuses just on the resume and the cover letter and the interview is really only looking at maybe a third of the picture. And I, so this book, The Best of Marty Nemco, covers all that. I will autograph it, of course, for you. So last time, and then we're going to go right back to the program, which is what you want, and I know you want it, and I want it too. 1-800-525-9917. Show your support for Work with Marty Nemco, Barbara Nemco, and KALW. 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org. What we're doing is, Barbara is trying to poke as many legitimate holes as she can into my book, Best of Marty Nemco, and hopefully the exchange will be elucidating and perhaps entertaining regarding for you as listeners as, or in your work life or that of somebody you love. All right, what's your next attack for on my book?
Well, you actually suggested that employers should use standardized tests of cognitive ability. I feel like that would be waving a red flag at the lawyers. Come, sue me, sue me.
Okay. Here's the facts, and this really is the facts. Studies have shown for all races, genders, etc., that the single best pencil and paper colorblind predictor, actually over-predicting for African Americans, of job performance is standardized cognitive tests. And it could be the SAT or the, you know, the old IQ tests or whatever. But there's a variety of those measures of cognitive ability, their ability to reason, to abstract, to take keep multiple ideas in your head at the same time and manipulate them, to learn quickly. Those are, you know, they're not perfect, but they are the single best and actually quite colorblind predictors of job performance. That said, a large employee, like and the guy who was on the show for, was the head of HR at Google. He said that it was they use it all the time. But Google has 10 zillion lawyers. So if somebody chooses to go and sue because they think somehow using a test of cognitive ability is unfair, they've got a phalanx of brilliant lawyers ready to take on the EOC. And a small company, usually, or a small nonprofit, they're usually not big enough fish for somebody to sue that small company or nonprofit. But where I would agree that it's dangerous is the mid-sized company. There are many mid-sized companies or mid-sized nonprofits that have maybe, 100 employees. They don't have a full-time lawyer on staff. So if somebody sues them and says, you shouldn't be using this test of cognitive ability because it's unfair to our group or whatever, they would have to pay the $400 or $500 an hour to a law firm to defend. And so for those mid-sized firms, I recommend you don't do it. But because these tests of cognitive ability are certainly not perfect at all, but as a piece of the puzzle in jobs that require good reasoning skills, good learning, quick learning ability, abstraction ability, that a large company or a small one might well want to consider the risk-reward ratio of using such tests as worth it.
As a public agency, I would walk far away from that.
Okay.
Even the colleges aren't using a lot of them anymore.
That's not true. Most colleges still use the UCs and the CSUs, for example, here in California, and almost all the privates do require an SAT, which is such an example of a cognitive test. Okay, hit me with another criticism of the book.
Okay. You recommended that a good way to get applicants is by getting referrals from trusted colleagues. And I have to tell you that the worst hire I ever did was a referral from a trusted colleague, which, of course, makes you say, do you really trust that colleague? But I think that the person probably did a fine job in the position they were in that situation. We were hiring for a higher level position. And so I think the Peter principle came into play, and the higher, when they were in this higher level position, the higher HIRE, the person in this more difficult position just didn't have the skills to do it. And I think I almost knew that during the interview, but I was blinded by this stellar recommendation I got from my trusted colleague.
Okay, you've got a number of problems there, Barbara. Number one, it's an N of one. You don't make generalizations about a policy based on an N of one. Number two, of course, if somebody was being recommended, but for this job is very different than the job he or she did before, that's very dangerous, and of course you don't rely on that. And the other danger that you are implying is that if it's somebody recommended by somebody you trust, there tends to be a halo effect.
Right.
And you do tend to think too much of them. That said, that can be compensated for. And that's an excellent thing to have brought up. Certainly, when you are getting a referral from somebody, you should be doubly aware to make sure that you are not judging them with a halo, but viewing them carefully. But knowing that you got them from a trusted person makes them more likely to be good, especially if you did a good job of explaining the job that they would be doing. Very often, there's no perfect solutions, but you take a stranger, and unfortunately, having been a career counselor to 5,400 clients, it is amazing the amount of machinations a stranger will do to look better than they are. Down to getting their girlfriend to pretend they're their boss and giving an amazing reference. Making, depending on the study, 30 to 50% of all resumes contain exaggerations or outright lying. And, some people may not do their own resume and hire a hired gun, so the employer who's reviewing the resume says, well, this guy really reasons well and argues well, it's so well organized. It could simply be they paid $500 to a hired gun. The getting a referral in general from respected people and giving a clear idea of the job, there is no perfect way to hire, but that's certainly a better screen. Now, I also want to, being a good, trying to be liberal here, because many workplaces are dominated by whites and Asians, that means people who you are referred are more likely to be of that same race. So I would invite people to redouble their efforts to be sure that the referrals are merit-based. And if, in fact, you always want the best candidate, and if, in fact, there is an overrepresentation of one race or gender, to make perhaps an additional effort to reach out to find highly qualified people of different races so that they have a fair shot at it, because it becomes a little bit of a circular problem if the only way you hire is through referrals, and they tend to be people of your own race. That's my thought about referrals. Your reactions?
I think those are really good points. I think mostly you need to keep in mind that you are having a halo effect, and two, you need to be very clear on whether the job that you're hiring for is really so similar to the job that they did. What happens is somebody's really good at one job, so then they apply for a level up, and it's hard to predict whether they'd be able to do that level up job.
Yeah, that's the Peter principle, and it's particularly likely to be true when in the field of education where you've been a teacher. The teacher then tries to become administrator. The skill set is so different that because they can deal with 20 or 30 kids in a classroom is completely different than dealing with a bunch of the regulations that come down from the state as an administrator, dealing with parents, dealing with teachers, evaluations, etc., and public speaking to adults. So I think it's particularly dangerous when in fields where the normal path upward requires a very, very different skill set.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And, of course, that's my only field of experience.
Of course. Well, fortunately, I've been privileged to, you know, as a career counselor, I get to deal with people from a wide range of experience. And being on this radio show, I've, you know, been blessed. I'm not a religious person, but I like that word. Blessed to have met so many interesting people who are callers to the show. And now I do need to ask you to call. To support KALW and Work with Marty Nemko. This is the only time in the last, this is the last 18 minutes. If you like Work with Marty Nemko and you like KALW, this is really the only time, you know, every dollar you give now, not after 7:59 or 8 o'clock, will, you know, is a vote for Work with Marty Nemko. And, of course, Barbara Nemko, my co-conspirator, longtime co-conspirator. 1-800-525-9917. Or KALW.org. That's 1-800-525-9917. For $120, and I think you can even pay it in installments if you like $10 a month or something, you get an autographed copy of my brand new published Best of Marty Nemko, which I'm feeling a little guilty about flogging too much because it looks like I'm hyping, so I'm not even going to do it. But I'm proud of the book. So I'm going to keep this real short. Barbara, just say something. We'll give out the phone number. We'll go back to hopefully being of value to our listeners.
Call now.
Oh, geez.
So we get credit for this show, Work with Marty Nemko.
Boy, that's brilliant. 1-800-525.
Well, it's simple.
It's simple, stupid,
right?
Yeah,
isn't
okay.
That the acronym?
All right. 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Okay. What we're doing here, by the way, is Barbara is criticizing that book. So lest you donate the $120 and get a crappy book or a book that you're not expecting, Barbara is trying to poke holes in the book. She's read it. Right, and, you know, she read it, you know, in the last week she read the career section, and she's come up with as many areas she potentially disagrees with or is quizzical about, and she's trying to get me to do a mea culpa. Barbara, you're so right. Okay, so what's your next criticism of the book?
Yeah, you haven't done that yet.
Well, I can't lie. You got to do a better job of criticizing.
All right. Well, take this.
Okay.
You say that self-employment is a good strategy for making a good living. And frankly, from where I sit, self-employment is terrifying. Mm-hmm. You have to do everything. You are the person who does everything from think up the ideas to implement them to pay the insurance to sweep the floor to worry about the electric to fix the door lock. You are the person. And I think that kind of a job is highly overrated.
I want to start by agreeing that in general you're correct, and I too am daunted.
Wait, score one for me.
A half. We'll get to the other half in a minute.
No, I want a whole one.
If the business is at all complex, it does end up requiring many hats, and there are very few people with the ability to be a part-time accountant, IT person, salesperson, purchaser, cleaner-upper, and self-motivated, and have the money to start a complex business and keep it running. That's why one of my very favorite phrases that I've concocted is called the status is the enemy of contentment. The most cool businesses are status businesses. They're high-tech, they're biotech, they're opening a restaurant, opening a sports bar, whatever. Those are cool, no question. But they are so likely to fail because there are so many moving parts. They need so much different expertise. That's why I am a big believer in low-status businesses, whether it be a service providing tutoring for autistic kids, or it's running a cart where you're selling beautiful Indian imported scarves at a near a BART station, or you're selling flowers in a stand near Kaiser Permanente Hospital. Those have fewer moving parts. There are no status, but they end up having a higher likelihood of success. And because it's true that any one of those is unlikely to make enough money to make you have a living income, especially here in the Bay Area, once you've cloned one flower stand or shoe shine stand or whatever the hell it is, you clone it and you find another great location. And having learned how to run that first location well, you find somebody excellent, could be a friend, could be not, but you treat somebody really well who you're going to hire to manage that second stand, and so that they're loyal and they don't steal from you, and you're just doing right livelihood for everybody. And you just run two or three of those, and the result is a much lower risk of business failure. And especially if you've not had great success in the standard corporate or nonprofit or government work world, that can be a way to go from schlepper to CEO instantly while still having a reasonable risk-reward ratio and being unlikely to go out of business too quickly.
Oh. Okay.
You know,
it's not for me.
Right.
Not for everybody, but I guess for some people it could be great.
Okay. Keep going. Ask me another hard question.
Okay. This one, I'm sorry. This one, I win.
Okay.
I win
up front. Wow. Okay. I'm girded for the challenge.
Indisputably.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. I do. You say that a person can live on $30,000 a year, that's your number, and be happier than a millionaire. And I'm sure that's true in Podunk. But in the Bay Area, for $30,000 a year, you can't rent a garage to put a fold-up bed in. So that's ridiculous. How can you possibly justify that statement?
If you are paying fair market rent, you cannot. But the single most important activity that a person can do to save money is to try to get below market rent. Either there are millions of people. My very first place I lived in Berkeley, I paid the equivalent of $400 a month to live in a palace up in the Berkeley Hills for somebody who was rich and didn't need money. She wanted a companion, an older woman. Or, you know, I think we are unfairly denigrating, quote, bad neighborhoods. The actual crime rate, the actual odds, not the rate, the odds of you getting attacked or robbed or whatever in a, quote, bad neighborhood is not much greater than in a good neighborhood, but the cost of rent is so much less. So one or two, spending the time, you won't fall into your lap, but taking the extra time and focus to identify either some kind of backyard cottage or attic apartment or a house share with a rich person in a rich neighborhood, and you can just put on telephone poles in those areas, you know, nice picture of yourself saying quiet, nice tenant, da 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 da. And also considering rentals in places that are, quote, not desirable, can be that one single move can enable you to get housing very cheaply. Now, of course, if you are a family of four, you know, your health insurance is going to cost too much. But Kaiser does offer, for example, I'm kind of a big Kaiser fan, does offer fairly low-cost policies, especially if you're working for an organization and the organization could, you know, if you're working at Walmart after 6 months, I did research to find this out, you're working at Walmart as a greeter, in 6 months you get health insurance. So that can be covered. And I also think that people are, you know, another big expense is cars. If one, and I've said this before on the radio, I am not a brand loyal person except for Toyota. They are made to run 300,000 miles, and yet after 200,000 and 15 years old, they're worth very little. You can buy a Toyota, a 20-year-old, 15-year-old Toyota very cheaply, and yet you still have reliable transportation and economical transportation. So that keeps your transportation costs. So do without a car. We have pretty good transportation if you're living in the city or whatever. And then food, people spend way too much on prepared foods. Some of the best foods, fruits and vegetables and breads and pastas and tuna fish and those things, oatmeal, those are among the cheapest and yet healthy foods, unlike packaged processed foods. And when you want to have a social life and go out, no, you don't need to go to places with $12 drinks or movies that cost $13. Invite people over to your place for popcorn and two-buck chuck wine and watch a movie on TV. It is possible to live on $30,000 a year, and most importantly, what is the benefit? Why are you happier? Because if you're only not needing to make a lot of money, you have tremendous freedom. You can be the artist you want to be, the musician, the performer, the nonprofit advocate. Meanwhile, remember I said that you can be happier than a millionaire. Do you know how many millionaires are sitting in their 4,000-foot mansion that is an albatross mortgage around their neck on their fourth martini or vaping
not
up a storm?
Not if they're millionaires.
Well, there's still, even if you're a millionaire, $1 million, if you're living in one of those mansions are cost $3 million, and so the mortgage is huge. They are working their butts off 60, 70 hours a week under great pressure for corporations to make that money doing work they don't really care about, and they are vaping up a storm or martinying up a storm, and they are very often less happy than the artist or the writer or the musician who's making $30,000 a year. And that's how I can make the seemingly absurd assertion that it is possible, no guarantee, take some effort, but it is possible to be a happier human being at $30,000 a year than a millionaire. Does that make sense?
I'm going to push back on that.
Great.
I think you told me I can't use an N of one, but you used an N of one that you lived in this mansion when you came to California and you paid very little rent. That only works if you are an N of one. It doesn't work for a family.
It's harder. No, I didn't say for a family. It's harder for family. I agree with that.
And if you if you decide you're going to live in a less, quote, less desirable neighborhood, one home robbery or home invasion or the windows of your car smashed, anything like that is going to cost you a lot of money.
Well,
so
my assertion was,
I'm not sure that's a great idea. And given what's going on today with drive-by shootings and gang violence,
not
I'm not suggesting that anybody go live in a bad neighborhood because the rent is cheap.
Not fair. The actual difference, the probability of you in a 5-year period of getting robbed, let alone assaulted, in a, quote, bad neighborhood is still, I don't know the exact numbers, is still 1 in 100 or less. And maybe it's 1 in 200 in a good neighborhood. But with 100% certitude, you're going to pay, instead of the crazy rents of $3,000 for a 1-bedroom or 2-bedroom, or $4,000 for a 2-bedroom in a nice area in San Francisco, you could be paying $1,000. And that is a huge, huge difference in terms of the freedom you buy yourself to do the work you want to do. Is it for everybody? No. But I think it is a perfectly defensible perspective. And what we try to do here on Work with Marty Nemco and KALW and Barbara Nemco is to provide thoughts that are not standard. I mean, what is public radio supposed to be? It's not supposed to be the same standard pap that you might hear if you were in Cincinnati listening to, to commercial radio.
Cincinnati.
I'm sorry, what?
It's a perfectly nice city.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, okay, we have time for one more of these or two of these questions.
Yeah, and I want to say one other thing.
Sure.
Yes, you don't need to live in the heart of San Francisco in the $4,000, $5,000 a month apartment. You can live outside of it where the rents are lower and commute in on BART, which
they're
is...
It's still crappy. It's unbelievable what people are paying even in Oakland. It's unbelievable. The rents are just obscene. I can't believe it. I feel sorry. I feel sorry for the people who are just coming up now. And but, having
well,
to pay these
too.
Rents.
That's true.
It's huge.
Okay,
it's
last
crazy.
Question.
Yeah.
Last question.
Okay.
You say that it isn't usually worth negotiating even for an extra $10,000? That's a lot of money.
Here's why. That extra $10,000 is your top $10,000. So let's say you were making $75,000. If you're negotiating for $85,000, because of our progressive tax system, that's going to be taxed at the highest rate, federal and state, where we have the highest state tax in the nation, and FICA. So you're losing roughly 50% of that $10,000. And the employer
is still $5,000.
Yeah,
I could do a lot on $5,000.
But you pay a price for that $5,000. Number one, you are heightening expect. If in fact, I'm not saying you always don't negotiate for $10,000, but if you're feeling it's a little risky, you risk A, getting the job pulled. They say, we've made you a good offer. You're just being, if that's not good enough, you're going to be a disgruntled employee. So you risk getting the offer pulled for $5,000, and if in fact you're getting paid more than others at your level, there's going to be heightened expectations for your productivity. And if in fact, you know, and most people don't like that much pressure. And if you have to perform better than your peers and you're going to be new, and if you're not doing well, you're more likely to get let go. And there could simply be some resentment. Yeah, you may have squeezed the last 5,000 out of the boss because the boss was afraid to tell his boss that he lost the number one person. But the actual benefit to your lifestyle of an extra $5,000 after taxes is only sometimes worth it. I don't make blanket rules. I love to live in the world of gray, not black and white. But most people would viscerally say, yes, I'm going to negotiate for $10,000 more, and I'm merely asking you to use discretion. And ask yourself about the risk-reward ratio. Is the likelihood of the job being pulled worth the extra $5,000 after taxes? Is the increased expectations for your performance? Is the resentment of your peers for making more because the word gets around? Is it worth it? The answer is sometimes yes and sometimes no.
Okay. I'll buy that.
Okay. All right.
Now let's see if people will buy us.
Exactly.
This is the last time you can either call or go online and pledge to KALW.
Yes.
And we would so appreciate it if you did.
And more important, I want you to think about why you're listening to the show. Do you like listening to Barbara and I debate? Do you like the career advice? Do you like when I interview guests? Do you like KALW because you like local public radio? Think of the other shows other than Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco that you like. If you like KALW enough to, what I say is, I say it's fair, call, pay your fair share. You know, we are a nonprofit organization. Barbara and I do not get paid at all. But it does cost money to run a radio station. If you like KALW, 1-800-525-9917. This is, we only have 2 minutes left, and then it's not a vote for Work with Marty Nemco anymore. It's just, you know, you could, it's great. I mean, I encourage you to donate to KALW for any reason, at any time.
But do it now.
If you
online.
If you like Work with Marty Nemco, this is the only time to do it. And, you know, and for $120, $10 a month, either way, cash or, you know, check or credit card or whatever, you get an autographed copy of my just published third edition of The Best of Marty Nemco, subtitle, The Best 86 of His 3,000 Articles for Your Work Life, Personal Life, and Making a Difference.
And even though I gave him a really hard time, it's a wonderful book.
1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org. I think all I want to do is, I don't want to do any more pitching. We've got another minute or two, but I'd like to thank my listeners. I really do appreciate you. I know you don't even like listening to these requests for money. First of all, I thank you for that. I thank you for 28 and a half years of loyal listenership. And those of you, you know, I was on for 28 years, Sundays from 11 to noon, and I'm happy, actually. I've been moved to this time between 7 and 8 because more people are still in their cars after work and thinking about work on Thursdays than they are Sundays. So a special shout-out to people who have migrated to from Sunday to my Thursday, and to the new folks who are just joining me. I really do value your listenership. I think people probably always say that, but I can tell you that I treat this as a real privilege, and I will promise to do my very best to be of support and help to you in your work lives, whether you pledge or not.
Okay, stop talking so they can call and get online.
Oh, okay. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, I'm going to share some deadly myths about job references. Until then, this is Marty Nemco for Barbara Nemco, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.